We're talking to Leslie Kane. Leslie's book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. We've just finished talking to Leslie on Dreamland, and at the end of Dreamland, we began to discuss the organization that Leslie is hoping to be set up within the United States government. And I'm wondering, Leslie, if John Podesta can be of any help to you in this respect.
Well, that's an interesting question, and, you know, he to the extent that he's willing to support this, he has stated that in his foreword, which people can read, and, you know, he's, you know, I can't say. To tell you the truth, I mean, I know that I could certainly consult with him about it and speak to him when we're ready to get moving on this, you know, which isn't going to be for a little while. I will certainly approach him, and I can't speak for him to what extent he will, you know, advocate for this, and I just can't say, but he has basically, you know, acknowledged that we are doing this in his foreword, and he says he believes that, you know, cooperation needs to occur. He said it's definitely time for government, scientists, and aviation experts to work together in unraveling the questions about UFOs, and that's, of course, what the purpose of this agency would be. So I'm hopeful that he will play a role, but I'm not no way saying that I know that he will. There are other people. Another person I'm working with is Governor Vice Symington, former governor of Arizona, who is well connected as also and is very much behind this work of trying to make change within the government. And there's others as well. So I think we have a great group of people who know how things work in Washington. And I've already received a lot of great advice, and I think there'll be more coming. And hopefully we're going to achieve the goal that we set out to do.
Well, yes, I certainly hope so, because and yet it seems to me that it might be a very, very difficult nut to crack for the reason that we alluded to on Dreamland, and that is that as soon as you do this, you immediately open a door to a whole hidden world almost. It may indeed be that the government has done very little about it, but what about all of these people who have had close encounters of the third kind or think they have? How is this explained to them once the slightest official recognition of the fact that there may be an intelligence flying around, they're going to say, these people are going to be asking what it's doing in their bedrooms, I think.
That's true. And, you know, I mean, hopefully if the thing is already in place, of course, the agency or the office or the official that's in charge, of course, once it's in place, they're just going to have to deal with that because they can't shut it down or they, you know, that's not going to happen. So it's very interesting because, you know, in the other countries that have these official agencies and, you know, obviously there are these encounter experiences going on all over the world.
Yes.
I don't think they've been able to handle it and manage it. It may be that it would be more intense. That aspect of it could be more intense in the United States than maybe in some of these other locations. There have been so many books about it and so much research and everything. So I think it's a really interesting question. And I'm just sort of hoping that they don't think too much about it in advance.
Well,
you know what I mean?
We got to get
the thing set up. Exactly. We get it set up, and then they're going to have to deal with whatever comes. And one of the things we propose is, of course, that we have very closely connected with this person, this point person at this agency, is a civilian volunteer board of, you know, retired military people, scientists, expert investigators, you know, very, very good people that will work closely with this official. They don't have to put money up for that. But let's say they meet quarterly and they'll make sure that everything is made public and they'll help the person and guide the person. And so with that kind of support for a little agency like this, hopefully they'll be able to assist. And whatever comes will come. And, you
yes.
know, but we can only look at it one step at a time. And the first step is to just quietly try and get something set up. And then we'll have to deal with what the repercussions are after that.
Well, one thinks in terms of the waste of knowledge that's going on right now, because if there are so many different ways that aren't particularly expensive to organize research on this subject and to organize even Skywatch in an efficient manner. I mean, by that, using cameras that can track objects moving through large areas of the sky. It's not an expensive process. but it might yield some really interesting results. There's a whole lot of different things that could be done. I wonder this, though. Why wouldn't the debunker community focus on getting the job, as it were, being the point people themselves? In other words, getting that job that once you've managed to get the agency set up, the next thing you know, or the office set up, I should say, the next thing you know, James Oberg is head of it.
Oh, boy, that's a really horrifying thought, really.
Well,
I mean, the way we've envisioned it is, I mean, if, let's say this is set up within the Air Force, there would be an Air Force staffer that would be assigned to it. So it's not going to be like some open job that people can just apply for from all over the place. It'll probably be some staffer who's already, or if it's within the NASA, it'll be some NASA person that's already in place that probably won't know a whole lot about the issue. And that's why we need to have this board of directors, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, working with them. So I don't think it's going to be like an open, and, you know, there would be so much, and if somebody like James Oberg was interested in, and if he even had access to the position, which I don't think would even be a possibility, I think there would be such an outcry. And, you know, I have to believe, Whitley, and this is, we want to believe the fact that if this thing is going to happen, the intentions behind it are going to be the right intentions. They're going to be good intentions. There's going to be a genuine desire upon, you know, within the mandate of this office to do the job that it's supposed to do. And I just don't think, given the kind of oversight that we hope would be provided, and that somebody could just sort of slip in there who was going to ruin the whole thing. I mean, I'm just not willing to entertain that could happen. But I'm glad you mentioned it. It's a terrifying thought.
Well, this is the United States of America, and you will be dealing at one point with the United States Congress. So believe me, anything can happen. Let's go on now. You are in the middle, in fact, of an author tour for the book, and you have been in some very big places publicly. I watched you on the Colbert Report, which was very impressive. The most impressive thing in many ways was Stephen Colbert's treatment of you. He could have ripped you to ribbons, and he did not do that. Do you know anything about what his actual feelings are or thoughts about this?
I mean, I think really that we all know that he's playing a character. And I don't know if you've probably watched him before, so you have a sense of what he's like in general.
Yeah, is he like that off the air?
No, only when he's in character. And the thing about it, if you haven't watched the show a lot, and I think it's true that some people just wanted to watch my clip of Colbert, and they had no idea who Stephen Colbert actually is.
No, very well who Stephen Colbert is.
So I think most
of my listeners do, too.
Okay, but he's basically playing a role. It's a satire, and I think that he treated me and my book the same way that he treats every other guest that he has on.
He always treated you like it was a serious book. He treated you exactly like he would treat a book from a Nobel Prize winner, frankly.
Yeah, he treated it as a serious book, and I think that's how he treats all the people that come on. I mean, unless it's somebody who's really off the wall. I mean, he is basically, I think Stephen Colbert is on the right side of the issues in general, and he will have people on whose issues he believes in, and yet his approach in dealing with them is to sort of make fun of it. But that's the way the message gets out. I mean, that's what he does. He's satirizing a kind of an extreme right-wing pundit like Bill O'Reilly or someone like that.
Yeah.
So he made it very clear to me. He came into the green room, and he does this with every guest. He came in, and he informed me before we went on. He said, I want you to know that I am playing a character, and I am a total jerk. And, you know, then that my job was to educate this jerk about something he knows absolutely nothing about.
Well,
and he was very concerned that I know.
He didn't play a total jerk with you. He took you, he was in character, but the questions he was asking were good questions.
I think you're right. I think it brought out good information, and I thought some of the stuff was just pure funny, like when he said about what if they're Muslims.
Yeah,
that
exactly. But you know, that's what Colbert is about.
He's
playing a character.
That's what he does. And he just, you know, he wants, and then at the end, he says, I hope I wasn't too much of a jerk. I mean, he knows that he has to play this character. He's brilliant at it. He really knows how to be that character. But he's also very aware that it's a character, and it's not what he really feels when he's sort of making fun of people. But I'm glad you felt that he was respectful. I think he was entirely respectful. I just think he had the same level of humor with me that he has with every other guest.
With every other guest, exactly.
Nothing different.
It wasn't more. It wasn't more.
He was not on some kind of attack against this book, and he was not out on some mission to ridicule UFOs. Absolutely not.
I agree with you. An absolute sea change, in my opinion. That there was, when, if I had gone on a show, in fact, I did. I went on Bill Maher when he was still on ABC.
Bill Maher can be really, really nasty.
Well, first of all, he has a different, I think Stephen Colbert is open to this. I can assure you,
sure.
Bill Maher is not and never will be.
Mm-hmm.
He had Michael Shermer, the debunker, on.
Right.
And prior to the show, unfortunately for Dr. Shermer, they did not know what I look like, and I can be a real little wild wallflower. And so I sat in the green room listening to him and Bill Maher discussing how they were going to wreck me.
Oh, geez.
They didn't know it was me. They had never, neither one of them had ever
seen
me.
Oh, they didn't know you were there listening.
They didn't know I was in the room. So I was sitting there right beside him listening to him. And the result was that it would have happened anyway, I might add, because Michael Shermer was slow and careful, and I'm not slow and careful. I have a different approach. And I wrecked him on the air and infuriated Bill Maher. And after the show, Shermer went stalking off in a fury. And Maher had said, and then you and Strieber will have a debate, and you'll win the debate. I'll make sure of that. He didn't win the debate. I made sure of that.
Well, congratulations. God, I'd like to see that tape sometime.
It's probably around somewhere.
It was a long time ago, right?
Oh, yeah, it was years and years ago. I am persona non grata on the media now. I can't get on anywhere. Because there has been a freezing up of resistance to the whole close encounter experience as more articulate people and more people are coming forward with this experience. The media is closing itself off from it and altogether. And to a degree, I think that's happening everywhere. Can you tell us, have you ever attempted, for example, to engage with Jimmy Carter about this?
No, I mean, I haven't, and it's certainly been in the back of my mind that, you know, now that this book is out there and it's getting such a fabulous response and being taken seriously, I mean, if ever there was an opportunity to get something to approach Jimmy Carter, this is it. Because people have tried before, and he's never been responsive, but there's never been anything like this before. And, you know, the other thing that I've got, Whitley, which is so helpful, of course, and you know this from your own publishing, is that I have a Random House behind this book. I'm not self-publishing here. This is a major publisher with a big PR department and marketing departments and a lot of clout. And that's one of the reasons the book is doing so well, is because of it's published by a major publisher. And that also helps in approaching somebody like Jimmy Carter.
Yes,
so,
it helps immensely.
I mean, it's something, once we get into sort of the phase, right now I'm just overwhelmed with just getting the book out there. But once we move into the phase a little bit more of actually trying to get something changed, and then we're going to be thinking about approaching people like Jimmy Carter, whether he might be willing to stand behind our efforts to get this little office set up, or whether he might be willing to make a statement endorsing the book. All those things can happen. It's just, we've got to, you know, right now we're overwhelmed because the book has just come out. But good idea, yeah.
He's been, you know, he went from being, before he was president, of saying that he was going to release everything, all the secrets, to being entirely unresponsive when he's asked about it now.
Right.
And
you know, James Fox caught him in that little clip on which was in his film, which you've probably seen, where he'll acknowledge that he saw something and he doesn't know what it was.
Right.
Remember, did you see the little clip where James Fox kind of got him? He went to a book signing with a camera.
Before his election, the atmosphere in this country was very different, and he spoke about
it
quite openly. And it wasn't like what happened to Denis Kucinich when he spoke about it,
and he was
wrecked on television viciously.
I know. That was just so cruel. I'll never forget that, and I just heard it again the other day because I was on an interview, and the person actually played it on this interview. And I mean, the poor guy, all he said was he saw an unidentified flying object.
Right.
He clarified it was just something unidentified.
My point is this. In Jimmy Carter's time, his sighting of an unidentified flying object did not identify him as a kook. But now, in Denis Kucinich's time, the situation is harder. He was brutalized for even mentioning that he'd seen such a thing.
Exactly. And he had no choice because they asked him.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they were nasty. But, you know,
they
I think part of that is people love that. I think that was part of the problem, too, is that the media loves to go after Dennis Kucinich because he's so progressive. And they do like to make fun of him and, you know, he's an easy target. Let's put it that way.
Well, exactly. He is an easy target. And Leslie, when... Let me go. I would like to talk now, if we can, a little bit about Fife Symington, who has. I know that you and Fife Symington have had quite a number of conversations together, and that. Tell me if you will. I've wanted to have him on Dreamland, in fact, and tell me if you will, what he's told you about what his change of mind was and why exactly. And for listeners, for those of you who don't know, Fife Symington was governor of Arizona during the Arizona, the Phoenix Lights, and came on and did a press conference after, right at the height of the thing, saying that he had the answer, and then had a staffer walk out in an alien costume and made it all into a big laugh. Then years later, what happened?
And then, really actually 10 years later, to be exact, he actually acknowledged. And again, it was James Fox, the filmmaker, who documented this for the first time. He acknowledged that he was actually a witness himself to the event. And it was just absolutely extraordinary because of what you just said, that he had this sort of ridiculing, what he calls a spoof. He calls it a spoof press conference. Nobody would have imagined for a second that he had seen the thing, but he actually did. And he carefully told me that he carefully considered with his wife whether he should talk about it or not, and it was a difficult decision, but he decided for a number of reasons, a lot of it being that he would be under so much ridicule from the press and wouldn't be able to get his work done, and it would just be such a big deal, you know, in the media if he said that he had seen it. He just decided not to say anything about it. But 10 years later, he thought, well, he's not in politics anymore. Enough time has passed. And he also felt that he wanted to make amends to his constituents, to the people that were hurt by that press conference. And he felt that, you know, he didn't want to hurt people. He didn't want to ridicule people. The way he felt about it was that there was such hysteria in the state at that point that he wanted to lighten the mood. He wanted to sort of shift gears a little bit. And because he's a man with a strong sense of humor and a kind of a creative guy, he just thought, okay, let's do this and see if we can lighten this up a little bit. Didn't know what to do. He really didn't know what to do. So that was sort of his explanation of why he did it. And again, it's an illustration of the lack of, you know, of action, of participation by the federal government in something as extraordinary as a huge object flying over a state and cities for an hour and a half. And, you know, the federal government should have been there assisting the governor. But, you know, these local officials are left with no support, no explanation, nothing. And this is an unprecedented situation. And he really, you know, was just sort of struggling with the best way to handle it. And this was one option he came up with, and he went ahead. And he felt it was successful, actually. It did kind of diffuse what he described as a building hysteria in the state. But he was left with no real way of making progress with the issue. That was the problem. So that's one reason why he's an advocate now for setting up this little office that we've been talking about. Because if such an office had been in place at the time, and I outline in the book, I describe the totally different situation we would have faced in Arizona if we'd had this little office set up. None of the problems he faced would have happened. And he realizes that, and he said in his book, in the book to me, and I quoted him, he does not want to see another governor have to go through what he went through, and he says it's only a matter of time before it will happen again.
Well, you know, it could be only a matter of time before they quit playing footsie with us and they resolve the issue of the secrecy themselves. And
That's another possibility. And don't we want to be prepared? Don't we want to beat them to the punch? I mean, you know.
We need to be prepared because I seem to remember that there used to be Incas around and Aztecs. They're gone. And they weren't prepared.
Exactly, Whitley. I think it's a really, really important point.
I think it's a very important
I mean, what if next time they fly over Phoenix and, you know, I mean, and the other issue that's scary about it is what do they have to do to inspire a kind of aggressive action on our part? I mean, what if they were so low over an Air Force base that we decided we wanted to try to shoot them down, and then it could get really dangerous.
Well, it could.
You know, I mean, you know, what if they were only 10 feet off the ground, shooting light beams down at people? People, I mean, then there really would be some serious reactions that would occur, and possibly physically aggressive reactions on our part, because none of our Air Force personnel are prepared for anything like this. And so that's a dangerous situation.
Or are they prepared, Leslie? You know, remember the Cash Landrum case in Houston?
Yes.
I talked to Betty Cash about it, and this was before I had Dreamland. But when I was sort of doing research on my own, and this was a case, folks, where these people saw an enormous triangle moving slowly through the sky on fire, surrounded by helicopters, and they were irradiated. They were burned, and they ended up with radiation poisoning, and they sued the United States government. And it was eventually, the suit was thrown out because they couldn't prove the government was responsible for what happened to them. But their lives were destroyed by this incident. However, Leslie, if there were, if those were real helicopters and there were people in them, Air Force personnel or Marines or someone, there must be a lot of people who know about this, and there must be a lot more going on behind the scenes than we think.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. And again, I'm not an expert on that case. I don't know, Whitley, was there some question as to whether that object was actually our own military craft? I'm really not an expert on that case, so...
Obviously
those helicopters know a lot about what it was, regardless of what it was.
Regardless of what it was, and whatever it was emitting radiation, which means that judging from the physical effects on the people who were close, which means that it almost certainly was not one of our craft, despite the efforts that have been made to pretend that that is the case. If you look into it a little bit more deeply, it turns out to be a classic example of something that we probably don't have and can't do. Now,
and it certainly was dangerous, irrespective. I mean, if people were burned by it, you know, that's a dangerous situation.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, they were radiated by it. They got cancer.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
This is the largest and most important of all mysteries. And I always think that if we were to deal with it in the way that you're suggesting, that we might be able to completely change our focus, which right now is to hide and to enforce in the public a state of ignorance by the use of denial and ridicule. But if that changed, what would be the sort of things that this office would investigate? Would it investigate, for example, close encounter experiences?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think initially it would be set up to investigate, you know, military cases, the sort of the standard kind of official world of cases, things that happen at military bases or very dramatic sightings like the one at O'Hare Airport where you have a lot of witnesses experiencing something. I don't think it would be, you know, taking every report that somebody called up about seeing some lights in the sky someplace. And, you know, I think that's how it has to be set up, Whitley, just to get it in place, you know, as just being limited to these kinds of very official, well-documented cases. And you know, initially it needs to start doing a lot of communicating with other agencies and also setting up a network of experts. This is what they've done in France. And, of course, we have a much bigger country here, but the model applies. That this officer in this agency would have a network of people that would be set up all over the country in all kinds of areas of expertise that could be called upon if an event were to happen in their locale. You know, different kinds of scientists, soil experts, weather experts, psychologists, all the people that might be needed to weigh in on a particular case. This wouldn't cost the government anything because these experts already exist.
Right.
So that would be in the beginning. A lot of it would be to sort of get the whole thing rolling. I mean, that's going to take a while. And then, you know, I agree with you that the encounters experiences need to be somehow incorporated. And I just think it has to be kind of a gradual evolution where it's going to be.
Let's focus on the sky
direction.
First. Let's focus on the sky first, and we'll get into
the
bedrooms
later. Yeah, I
mean,
you have to take it, and that's why my book only focuses on that because it's like one step at a time. You have to first of all reach the official world, which doesn't even acknowledge that the things even exist in the sky, right? And that's what I'm trying to get through to them, and that's the first step. That's what the information you have to approach them with, because they're not, they cannot handle anything else. They're not going to handle anything too far out at this point. You have to go like one step at a time. It's like UFO 101, you know?
Right.
But providing the most valid, most credible information that exists. And it's mind-blowing, that information. I mean, that alone is extraordinary information. Even without these other aspects being included, it's utterly extraordinary. And it's the kind of information that they cannot say is invalid. They just absolutely can't say it. And I think the challenge is getting them to actually read the book. Because once you read the book, there's no question in your, there just can't be a question in your mind that there's nothing going on. So I think their only recourse, if they don't want to deal with it, is to avoid reading it. And
well,
that's the challenge, is how do you get them to sit down and read the thing?
That is your achievement, and that's what makes the book so important, because that is literally true. If you read this, you can't, it's undeniable. That's why.
It's undeniable. I mean, it's basically proof.
Right.
I think you can even use the word proof.
It is proof.
That there is a physical phenomenon, and we say that in the book, and the writers agree. There is an unknown physical phenomenon in our sky. It behaves like X, Y, and Z. We have this, you know, and that is a fact.
Yes.
And so anybody reading it is going to say, wow, well, don't we want to know what they are? Let's find out. That's sort of the premise of the book. We got this, we've got this thing going on. I mean, for what reason would we not want to find out what they are? You
ostriches
know?
Have strong necks, Leslie.
I know.
They don't want to come up out of that sand.
I certainly think the general public is going to want to know.
Oh, yes. I think anybody who reads this, and folks, this is why, this is the kind of book, you don't have to conceal the fact that you're reading this book. This book is important. This book is from a major publisher. This book changes minds fundamentally. And so please let your friends see it. And I know all of you listening at this stage in the subscriber section are people who have had, almost all of you have had encounters, have seen UFOs, or are intensely interested for one reason or another. Take this book and become its evangelist. Get it out there. Help do this. Give it to your congressman, especially if you know
him,
and some of you do.
Especially if you know people, professional people, people that have connections to government officials, even on the local level, anybody that sort of is part of the cultural elite, as we might say, you know, they're the ones that need to get to be asked to read this book. So those are the people that, you know, all of us can get copies of the book and try to sort of send it up the chain to the right places. And it's going to take everybody cooperating to make this happen. So
yes.
I echo what you're saying, Whitley. I really hope that people will. And the book is not, if you go to Amazon.com, by the way, which you can go to from your website, it's not that expensive a book either, even though it's, you know, because Amazon is offering it at a very good price. So it's very affordable. And it's a power bomb. You can use it as a weapon.
You can
I really think it's
as
a weapon.
A weapon. This is definitely a torpedo. No question about that. So folks, use it. You can hold your heads high now. Every one of you who is involved in this is involved in the most extraordinary thing that has ever happened to mankind. We are at the absolute leading edge of the human species. It's a very extraordinary and a very humbling place for all of us to be. And Leslie, it's certainly there too. And Leslie, I would like to thank you for very much for being with us. UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. Go on the record, folks, as having bought this book, read it, and done what you could to spread the word. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you so much, Whitley. I appreciate that very much.